Hello, hello, and welcome back or welcome to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and I'm fired up because it is ball time. That's right. How great is ball? Football season. We are rolling. We are finding our groove, and away we go. Last time we talked, we had a couple season previews from training camps with the Pac-12 Network's Ashley Adamson and Mike Yam as we were bouncing around the conference. And then the season started, and I was bouncing around the country. Week one had three games, and then kind of settled in week two, just called the UCLA game a week ago on the Pac-12 Network as they beat Hawaii. And here we are heading into week three. Now, in college football, whoever your favorite team is, I'm sure you're jacked up about week three because you're either undefeated, you're kind of in the middle trying to figure it out, or you desperately need a win. Now, here in Southern California, week three is a week that has been circled on the calendar for over a decade because it's USC and Texas, the rematch of the national championship game that I really think, even if you weren't a college football fan, you probably watched because it was epic. The Trojans were on their way to their third straight potential title under Pete Carroll, and Texas was trying to prove that they had the greatest player in the country in Vince Young, and it was on. It was also, for me, my first year ever coaching major college football. I was 23 years old at the Rose Bowl thinking I would never lose a game in my entire coaching career, let alone a big championship one, and it was an epic environment. And it got me thinking about environments as a broadcaster, because as you get up to the booth to call games, and now I can't believe it, but I'm in my ninth year doing this, what I love is seeing a sold-out crowd. What I love is listening to my partner, Ted Robinson, talk about big plays and just kind of just raise his voice and raise the energy on television. And I also like taking my headset off on third downs every once in a while, or big plays in the red zone or throughout the game, just listening to the crowd and the energy and the vibe, because it's really real, as all of us really know. And so I brought on, in this podcast episode, I want to have a conversation around energy, around the vibe in a stadium. So I brought on Ariel Joseph Town. Now, you may remember that name because he was a previous guest on this podcast. He was actually on twice. He's the master and the guru in Feng Shui, the power of energy, the art of energy. And he came to my home, and he is a working actor in Los Angeles. He is also a Feng Shui master to celebrities, to normal people like myself, to a lot of different people. And he's an incredible human being. He's just a special guy who has a great insight on the planet and specifically on energy. And here I am walking into college football season so jacked about it. And I was like, man, let's have a conversation about this. You know, different stadiums have different energies. Whether you're an NFL fan, you go to Seahawks games, you're a college fan and you go to Salt Lake City and you go to Rice-Eccles Stadium, wherever you go, there's a vibe. And as a fan, you love that vibe and you bring your vibe to that and your energy to that. So I was like, let's have a conversation about it and not just talk about how exciting we get or how loud we get or what we stand until they get a first down or whatever it may be. And Joe breaks it down. I mean, it is really cool. He talks about the details of it, so you can totally nerd out about this. He talks about rituals and how, like, we got to change our socks or change our food. He also talks about, I think, the most powerful element is about parents and how parents can react in games. And he tells this story that I think will have all of us reflecting about our childhood and what it was like to watch games with either our parents or adults and the stress that it caused on us if they were an Uber fan or whatever our reaction may be. I think you'll dig it. Joe and I sat down and we did this one in the preseason. We did it at a park in Los Angeles. So you're going to hear some people, you might hear a siren, you might hear a plane, you're going to hear some wind. But I really think it's a fun conversation. So I hope you enjoy it wherever you are. As always, let me know your thoughts. We're going to be dropping a pod pretty much every week through the rest of the season. They're going to be fun. They're going to be interesting. They're about football. They're not going to be about football. Kind of all across the board. I think you'll dig it. And I also, before I jump into this conversation, I want to make sure I let you know about this other podcast I'm hosting now called the Season of Sam podcast. And this is with USC quarterback Sam Darnold. And it's a really fun podcast for me because we've cultivated a masterclass for this young man, where every single week I'll interview him about the previous week, about a story in his life that you may not have heard yet, and then he'll interview somebody. So this week we actually interviewed the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll, because USC is playing Texas and it just kind of timed out right. And it's really fun to listen to Sam interview a guy he's never met, but somebody he really idolizes growing up in Southern California amid that run that USC had when the energy was off the hook. So check that one out on Apple Podcasts. And we always finish up the Season of Sam podcast by interviewing a coach or a teammate. And this week, it's Deontay Burnett, who you probably remember from going off in the Rose Bowl, and he had an incredible game a week ago against Stanford. So that's kind of the news that I'm up to. But it's college football season. It's around midnight. I just finished watching film, editing this podcast, and I can't wait till you dive in, because I think this one will prime you for your weekend, and I bet it influences the rest of your life as a sports fan. Let me get out of the way. This is Ariel Joseph Town around feng shui, energy, stadiums, and the power of sport. I want to talk to you. This is going to be a unique podcast because it's kind of off the whim a little bit. The previous conversation we had, which will be linked in the show notes, was literally around the art of your story, which was kind of two different careers, same individual. We talked about you as a feng shui master, energy guru, that part of your life, as well as an actor and a performer and a producer and a writer, and how those two blended. And then you actually shuied my space, which changed my life. I thought it did then. I didn't realize how much it did until it truly went into effect. So I owe you a big thank you, first and foremost.
Well, it was such a joy. And I think we're coming up on a year now, right?
Oh, yeah. We're more than a year. Yeah.
That's
yeah,
incredible.
More than a year. It was insane. But I want to talk to you about energy today.
Yeah.
And I think for sports fans, we relate to energy really well, right? I mean, it happens everywhere. You go into the stadium, you're like, man, it just shifted. Everything turned. It was third down stop, right? And we could look at that as, you know, the energy, the vibe, the crowd, the quarterback, but ultimately the feng shui, the feng shui of that incident. I look at you and I think you're a disruptor. You walk into spaces and you change them. You walk into a room and your presence is felt. Now, it's a gracious disruptor. In acting, you call it the gracious host. I'm curious if you've ever seen yourself like that.
Seeing myself as a disruptor. You know, it's funny. This word is really an important thing that we're talking about right now, because the idea of disruption always feels so rebellious. And I definitely feel like I'm a rule breaker. But I got to learn the rules before I feel like I can break them. As a feng shui person who studied one form and then really just immersed myself in it, eventually I started to learn, like, oh, I've got something to say about this too. So coming at feng shui from a more intuitive approach feels like a disruption to what I always, you know, had been practicing before that. But when I think back on life, like, my mom created sacred spaces. My mom was, like, creating a great environment, you know, perfect environment to eat in or gather in and things like that. And she might not have called it feng shui, but she was doing the same thing. So I may be taking the reins there a little bit. And this idea of disrupting feels good as long as it's got a positive quality to it. And I'm not just like Loki messing stuff up, you know?
Right. Do you have a memory where you think back and maybe you're in a stadium, maybe you're in college at SC, where you're like, whoa, the energy just shifted. I mean, the college scene in and of itself, and, you know, I've been in there a bunch, running around as a coach, as a college analyst. The energy there is unique, right? JFK did his acceptance speech there. The Olympics have been there. They play Dodger baseball there. Obviously, the Trojans have played there. The Rams are there. There's a lot of energy in that Coliseum. Do you have a moment in your career, maybe it was as a kid in your first Mets game or Yankees game, where you were like, whoa, energy in stadiums is legit?
100%. I mean, I felt it probably more at my first Knicks game in New York than I did in my first Yankees game. My first Yankees game, I just fell in love with my favorite ball player. I saw Dave Winfield. He almost hit for the cycle. I was like, that's my favorite guy. Impulse buy. That's me. Going to the Knicks was like an experience. Madison Square Garden. It was back in the 80s. It was smoky. It was loud. I was in like the back row. Like, there was no back row behind me. I was in the very last row, and I was like 7 and couldn't really see, and it was loud. And, you know, I definitely felt like the crowd was involved. I don't know if they were very good back then. I think it was maybe right before Patrick Ewing came in, sort of like a team that I understood a little better. But I've definitely felt it in football. My mom, little hippie woman, comes out for the first few weeks of my freshman year of college, and she comes with me to the Coliseum. And I'm looking at her about halfway through the second quarter, and we've heard, you know, the fight song now a few times, and people are throwing up the victory sign, and my mom's doing it. little hippie mom is fighting on. And at that moment, I realized, oh my God, this is like the first time in my life that tens of thousands of people are all rooting for the same thing. And that was powerful because that gives me insight into how people get swept up into crowds and, like, you know, crowd mentality and understanding the positive and negative impacts of that. That was a powerful moment.
Okay, so my first weekend in college football is going to be awesome this year. I'm going to go to Rice-Eccles Stadium to start the season off, Utah.
Yeah.
They've sold out 40-some straight games.
Whoa.
Then Friday, I'm going to go to see Colorado State, rivalry game, do pre- and post-game show there. And Saturday, I'm going to go to Autzen Stadium in Oregon. I think all these college football fans, we all think our stadium is the bomb. You know, it's the hardest place to play. It's the most raucous environment. Number one, how big of an advantage is the energy of a stadium in your opinion? And when you walk into a stadium, you know, you're a big Seahawks fan. So you walk into SeaTac, can you tell, like, which stadiums provide an advantage, if that's actually the case? Or is it just fandom where we think our stadium has an advantage?
This is such a great question, man. I've been thinking about this so much, and I've been so pumped to talk to you in particular about it, because I feel like we can talk about it not just on a surface level, but actually go deep into the different layers.
Go,
so I've got some different, like, layers to what I think the feng shui of stadiums can be. One of the first things that I noticed is, you know, you can walk into a space and be visually intimidated. So the first time I actually went to CenturyLink Field, I'm going up the steps from the parking lot into the stadium, and I have to walk through four huge, like, two-story posters of the LOB. So here I am. I'm walking into the entrance of the stadium, and I have to walk by their four most intimidating players. So if I'm a fan of the other team, fill-in-the-blank team, I'm already maybe getting some goosebumps and some chills up my spine. Now, I don't know how to apply that necessarily to the tunnel where the opposing players have to walk through. But from a feng shui perspective, what they're doing there is called guardians of the gate. So one of the things that I fell in love with about feng shui is not just where it came from, China, and how it evolved here and really became part of our culture in the 70s and 80s as Japanese businessmen started investing into American culture and American businesses. But when I started to realize how universal it was. So if you go to the New York Public Library and you're walking up the steps, what do you see on either side?
The lions, right?
A couple lions, right? Yeah. So you've been to Paris recently.
Yeah.
You go to Notre Dame Cathedral. You go up the steps. What do you see when you look up? Did you look up? Gargoyles, man. They're guarding it from every single side. Okay. There's like these like intimidating, scary faces that are warding off evil spirits. So whether you're talking about a mezuzah on the front door or whether you're talking about lions or foo dogs in the entranceway to Chinatown downtown, you're talking about having people, statues, symbols of guardians on both sides of the entranceway that are meant to separate the energy from the outside of the space from the inside of the space so that everything that happens inside has a different energy and feel and flavor and sacredness to it. So when I went up the steps to CenturyLink Field, I could feel that walking under the LOB.
Whoa. Okay, so that's like step one, right?
Step one,
and I think it's
cues,
true, right? Like, I always, one of my favorite things, I'll get to a campus early just because I can't sleep and I don't want to sit in my hotel and watch games all day. And I get there and I'll just walk around the tailgating. And sometimes I'll drop in and see what people are doing. But, you know, as fans, I think we kind of prime ourselves, right? And that could be in the form of like a nice cold Coors Light or a, you know, some brats or whatever, some wine and cheese, depending upon your fan base, right, and the stereotype around that. But it's almost as though you're priming yourself as a fan to also walk in. So if step one, I'm going to guess here, I could be way wrong.
Please.
But if step one is like walking through the gargoyles, right, or the posters of these, you know, student athletes or pros, is step two like the physical people walking in and bringing their juice? Or is it like when you walk in, okay, now it's the structure of the inside of the stadium?
Yeah, I don't know. It probably works either way. A lot of times people come in now and they get there kind of early. You know, they're either tailgating outside or they want to go in and like feel the vibe of the stadium. They want to be there for everything. They don't want to miss anything. They want to watch Steph Curry's like amazing warm up, right? They want to watch their favorite players throwing the ball around. Sometimes the head coach, you know, I got to go to the Super Bowl a couple years ago and watching Pete out there before the game throwing the ball around, like getting his own energy up was pretty sacred. And that was before a lot of people showed up. So I think there's like a vibe to the stadium. So once I've gone through the entranceway, there's the stadium vibe. And there's the stadium vibe when it's just existing as a structure and all the energy that's come from that before. And then there's a different vibe once the 12s come in, once the, you know, the Trojans come in, like once Phil and your favorite team come in and they bring their, you know, their version of rock and energy.
Okay, so let's talk about the student sections.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's really fun. I love being up in the booth and watching the gates open 2 hours before the game and students are sprinting in. Some of these campuses, and I'm going to keep it on the Pac-12 campuses because that's where I'm at the most, they have their area, right? Arizona, Washington State, Oregon State, they line it like it's a basketball game. Mm. And they're literally like they're on the floor, right? And there's probably 20 rows, but it's literally across the sideline behind the bench, right? Arizona State, they've moved theirs to the end zone. I'm curious where they have now their new stadium in the rebuild. I'm not sure where they are this coming season. Utah, they've got half of a side of the stadium behind their sideline. USC, very similar spacing. In terms of the energy of the stadium, which we all believe in as fans, but now we're taking another level with you as, you know, the feng shui master here on the podcast. And by the way, we're in the middle of a park in LA, which is awesome. So there's energy all around us, people walking and hiking, playing with their kids. So that's the background noise. But curious if where the student sections are in your eyes contributes to the specific energy created in the stadium.
Yeah, I think that there's layers to which you can apply feng shui to every aspect of design. And there's this concept that there's different parts of a space that relate to different parts of your fill in the blank, your life, your work life, in this case, the sporting events. So like there might be a community section of a stadium. Now, that's a little weird to think about that because the community's everywhere. So the idea of just limiting it to one area is something that sort of bumps me a little bit about that exploration of feng shui. The idea that like this part is only for this and nothing else. Mm. This part is only for this and nothing else. So in feng shui, those are called guas or areas. And you would use the entranceway in Western feng shui to lay out these nine areas. Like where do the benefactors sit, the helpful people? Where do the people who set the vision for the team and the, you know, the sort of direction that they're heading in.
So that'd be like the athletic department and the donors, for instance.
Yes, okay. Totally. Like, right, exactly. So the idea of like students being the embodiment of it, like that's the family, right? The family and the community. So in Western feng shui, that would be explored through the middle left-hand side of the space. So if you were looking at a square and you came in through the bottom of the square, on the left-hand side in the middle is where you'd put the community and the family from that standpoint. But I think that what's interesting about every single stadium you just mentioned is there's intention behind it. And so in 2017, our exploration of feng shui, I think the idea is like, have purpose, have a, you know, you always talk about coaches, do they have a philosophy? So I think that that needs to extend to not just designing stadiums for corporate profit, because that's 1/9 of the equation. But how do you celebrate the people that are there? How do you make sure the energy is right? How do you make sure it's balanced? How do you make sure that the whole community is aligned with a similar vision? That, to me, is equally as important as generating profit.
Really interesting. Here with Ariel Joseph Town, feng shui master, as well as actor, writer, producer, performer, and a bunch of things that we'll link, obviously, in the show notes. Joe, I'm curious about the tunnel, right? The tunnel for me as an athlete, you know, when I was back at Pitt, if you played a good game, one of two things happened. You either were named a captain or you were named the guy who led the team on the walkout. I can remember my sophomore year, I play well in the first game of the season, and the second game I got to lead the walkout. And it was like the coolest thing, right? Because all the cameras, it was 17 years ago, and you know the cameras were on you, you're on the big screen. Now teams have taken it to a completely different level with the walkout, with the video, with the smoke, with the lights, with all of that stuff. Is that overrated? Is it underrated? Are the fans that are hanging over where they come out critical? I'm just kind of curious because there's clearly a lot of production value. And for a guy that is a producer, a director, and a writer, and an actor, I'm sure you'd take, you know, an extra moment of appreciation for that type of production skill.
Absolutely. I think that there's two layers to this that relate to the tunnel. The first one is, for the fans, there's a sense of anticipation. So like the idea of like, I hear it, but I can't see it yet. I know something's about to happen. That feeling energizes the crowd. So, you know, from the outside perspective, you know, let it rip and, you know, Give me a bird's eye view into being inside that tunnel and let me experience it. Let me get pumped up. Let me get excited. And, you know, whether that's smoke, whether that's music, whatever it is you choose to make that anticipation build to a crescendo, there are a lot smarter people than I that have to do with, like, you know, the inner mechanics of what would get that crowd going. Specific vibrations of notes, specific rhythms of songs, like those kind of things I know a little bit about, but they're definitely factors, right? In the same way that McDonald's uses red and yellow and primary colors to try to make us hungry and make us want that food, there are specific things on an energetic level that can get the crowd in the right mind space for what's about to happen. On the flip side, it's a transition for players, either from battle back into recuperation or from pregame into battle. And so honoring that and allowing those people to have their process, I think, has to be paramount to, I don't know, looking at players like take care of themselves in that pregame bubble. I'd rather, as a fan, let them be the best versions of themselves so I have a better experience watching the game than to have access.
Okay. The game of football is in danger. You know, obviously, if you saw the report in the New York Times just came out, around concussions and CTE.
Yeah.
You know, you're a parent now.
Yeah.
I will put you on the spot and ask you if you're going to allow your son to play. I'd be curious, or at least where that exploration is right now, if you've had those conversations. But also, I want to talk to you about what I call CBL, Championship Body Language, right? And there's an energetic element to that. And as an analyst, I'm always looking at body language, nonverbals, how they're communicating after an incompletion, after three and out, after not converting a big time third down. I'm curious first, do you believe that, you know, you're going to allow your son, if you had to today, to play what I believe is the greatest team building sport of all time, to put a little heat on you? But also, how do you view body language energetically in a state for the individual, a home team, and an away team?
Man, four great questions. So, okay, let's do the big frog first. Luke is his own person. So I'm not going to make any decisions for him about what he can do. As a parent protecting him, there are going to be conversations that his mom and I are going to have about what he can't do, either at a certain age or after a certain age. We are completely expecting that he, if he is interested in team sports, would play team sports up until a level of contact, and we'd have to revisit at that point. So the idea of him being part of a group, the idea of him learning the team building skills, the idea of him exploring through joy and fun, you know, I don't know what he's going to be into. I mean, I thought I was going to be a professional baseball player for a few years, and I explored that and went to Trenton State College in the summers, 3 years, and, you know, really explored ball, and I ended up falling in love with acting. So my feeling is that Luke is going to be a musician, and he is going to play basketball just because he has been so interested in basketball during March Madness of this year at, what was it, I guess at that point, 3 months old. Going to his first ball game was Atlanta Hawks versus the Portland Trailblazers. For some reason, he seems really into basketball. So I want him to follow his joy. Like, I want him to follow, like, what he's into. So it's going to be hard to restrict that. And hopefully, like, one of the things I appreciate most about Coach Carroll and some of what he's trying to do in the sport of football is look to rugby and look to avoid head-to-head injuries and change the game of ball so that it can still be vigorous and enjoyable to watch, but maybe a little safer. And maybe that can change opinions as we sort of get closer to that date. The other part of the question, I think, is about body language, and there's energy to that. Like, I didn't have a lot of confidence for quite a few years, and my uncle bought me this body language book. I remember because it was at this natural food store in Malibu, and it really was pretty cool because it sort of asked you to act as if you were already the energy you sought. And as an actor, that's what we do all the time. We're constantly, like, acting as if we are the character and embodying something. And so as a form of manifesting in my life, I've taken on being something before I was that thing fully by filling myself up with as much of that as possible until it felt more possible and more real, leaning into a future, if you will. So it really depends on if these athletes are reacting to the past, not able to shake it off in the moment, or if they're demonstrating like their version of the top of the mountain. I love watching body language. I think it's really interesting as a fan to watch the body language of someone who looks defeated. Fortunately, I don't see that in the quarterback on my favorite NFL team right now. I don't tend to see him get down. He tends to pick himself up pretty quickly and get back out there. That may not be the time for him to process that disappointment. There are other players who have recently even been to the Super Bowl who I might say put a towel over their head, look kind of dejected. They don't look like the smiling, confident versions of themselves. And my question is, like, why is that? Yes, clearly you're a human being and you're disappointed, but like, is that what you want to demonstrate for all the people that are watching at home and all of your players and staff? And doesn't instill confidence in me. So I think from a fan perspective, I'm going to take the lead off of the coaches. Are they yelling? Are they, you know, like seeming like they're frustrated with the situation? Or not that certain moments don't call for, you know, a little direct, uncomfortable conversation. Does that make sense, though?
Yeah. I'm curious because energy is a huge element in games, right? Yeah. And I asked you the question about CTE and if you'd play, you know, you'd allow your son Luke to play or would urge him to play. Because after a big hit, the energy in a stadium changes, mm-hmm. right? And we see it all the time. And now, especially in college football, the reviewing of targeting is as hot of a topic as possible. And yeah. I usually go out on a big limb broadcasting, and I'm a huge fan of the penalty. And I'm okay with them taking the kid and escorting him to the locker room and not coming back. I think the penalty is the only way we're going to save and change the game so your son is confident enough to play. And his parents are confident enough to say, you know what, I'm not worried about brain injury.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, he's 12, 14 years away from playing. So we got a little time for little Luke, you know, so the possibility of him being, you know, starting safety for the USC Trojans is still there for you, man. But on that note, I ask you that because when I'm in those stadiums, even broadcasting, the energy shifts, right? What happens there? For an energy expert, you know, what's really occurring there? Like, is it a collective source of empathy, right? Because let's just call it 80-20, 70-30 home fans, away fans, at just your standard average Pac-12 conference game. And that's just a general layman's take, but I'm curious what an expert would say.
So are you asking what's happening inside the crowd at those moments?
Yeah, I'm curious when you're in a stadium and all of a sudden big hit happens, right? All of a sudden a team doesn't do well. You know, like I'm kind of just curious of what the energy does. And the follow-up will be, well, how can these fans bring it back?
Yeah, it feels to me like there are these waves of emotion that crowds go through. And obviously success breeds success and disappointing series breed frustration. And all the things that come with that, you know, negative talk, excessive drinking, you know, all the different things that probably come along with feeling disappointed and not knowing how to manage that. And I know, look, there are people designed to rally us. You know, you go to a taping of a show and there's somebody to warm up the crowd. You know, there's crowd warmers at sporting events too. And sometimes they're effective and sometimes they're not. Sometimes the crowds in LA are busy trying to get the wave going and they're not as focused. And that's interesting to me. But after a big momentum-changing moment, especially where it sucks all the oxygen out of the room, I think it does move us from gladiators into our hearts. I definitely think it's collective empathy. That's a great word, and I've felt it. And I think it's really classy when an organization, a team, a group of fans hold their breath and, you know, are there for, you know, they're not about themselves in that moment,
right?
You know, and I saw that not too long ago in Dallas. There was a pretty big game, and there was a player who was involved, you know, pretty intensely for the Seahawks for a couple years, named Ricardo Lockett. And, you know, I saw the play that ended his career. It almost ended his life. I mean, he was lying down on the ground, and apparently if he had tried to sit up, it wouldn't have been good for him. So the trainers, who he went back and thanked later, definitely saved his life on the field. And then the people in the hospital followed up on it. And even at home, you know, I think we experienced that, You know, it's like they captured it really well in the movie Jerry Maguire with Rod Tidwell.
Right.
You know, please get up, you know, and Cameron Crowe taking the sound out and, you know, Jerry just running down the tunnel, you know, I mean, that was an incredibly powerful moment for me watching a movie. And I think they captured what I've felt as a fan in those moments. And all you want to do is, send visions of, helpfulness, health, healing, prayers, like whatever, light to those people. And the only thing I don't want to hear is a awkward comment from a commentator. You know, I mean, in that movie, they did it pretty well. I think the line was something like, at a moment like this, you just hope that his family's not watching. And we're watching the family watching, you know. And of course, I think the commentator in that is, you know, obviously trying to protect the family from what they're seeing. But, you know, how to frame a moment like that is important. I think they're, when people hold up the victory sign or they give a moment of silence or they give respect, it's really, really classy, and that's how I'd like to see things happen.
This year I'm going to call week two Hawaii at UCLA.
Nice.
And Nick Rolovich, the head coach at Hawaii last year, his team wasn't playing well, and he decided to take away the sideline benches. So they couldn't sit on the sideline in the second half because he didn't think the enthusiasm on the sideline was what he wanted. For a guy that, you know, you swayed my place, right, and there's an element of balance,
yes,
right, whether it's the amount of, like, you know, trinkets I have from travels, like making sure that it's not an odd number, right? That was an element we did in my kitchen. Or making sure that I have two nightstands, you know, so I don't have one to represent a quote-unquote one-nightstand, but represent partnership and sharing. You do something like that in a game, and you're watching it as, you know, a guy who studied this, you know, energy and feng shui for a long time. What's a reaction that you would have?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, like, okay, if the coach noticed it, if I'm an astute fan, I'm probably noticed it too. These guys are playing lackluster. They don't seem to be playing with energy. So I need to change it up. And you and I have talked about that from the standpoint of, like, how do you turn the momentum of a game? And coaches can do that in a lot of different ways, right? They can come out and they can chew out a ref if they've been getting harassed. Sometimes that's enough to spark the energy of, you know, everyone. Sometimes they're one of their vocal leaders in the locker room comes out and they huddle everyone together. In this case, it was no lethargy, you know, no sitting back. So I like that from that standpoint. However, I think that in the subtle art of, like, energy expenditure, it's probably better to not have them waste energy on the sideline. So I'd be interested from the standpoint of, like, how do you conserve, you know, when you're not needed? How do you conserve? So you look at Steve Prefontaine, you know, there's a great movie called Without Limits, and his philosophy was, I need to run full tilt. I don't want to draft off anyone else. I want to just leave everything out there. And if I do that, I think it's a pure guts race and nobody's going to beat me. And I think that's really admirable, and that's how I tend to play in life. And I think there's some people that are a lot smarter than me that have said, if you're going to play that hard, you have to recover that hard. Question is, like, when do you recover? You know, does it make sense to do that if you're losing the game in the second half? Like, recover in the ice bath.
Right.
Recover in the cryo freeze. Recover in your bed, you know?
How about halftime? You know, I've got a couple notes that I always look at every game on the call sheet that I have. You've been in the booth with me before. And one says, first quarter of the third drive, pay attention.
Hmm.
So when coaches take their teams in their locker room, clearly we don't know what's being said specifically. But we do know what the crowd does, right? We've done it, right, as fans. We've gone out. To me, I'm a huge pretzel fan at games. I usually get two or three of them at halftime. Bring them back. I got some mustard. I'm a little late. What's your advice to fans around getting back and recreating an energy that they hope to have to start the third quarter? Because you're coming off of a break.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, what is the first move? Does the first move come from us, the fan? It can. You know, getting myself right, probably, because I can't really affect a lot of people around me unless I decide to do a chant or a cheer or try to do a wave or something. A lot of that, I think, is up to coaching style and setting the tone, you know, early into the second half, because there are some coaches that probably want to, like, slowly step on the neck of the opponent, start, you know, wearing them down.
Yeah.
And there are other people that might want like a big play to like re-energize the crowd and get them to like focus back in. So I think it's a combination of both. I mean, you and I both appreciated the work of one Ray Malaluga. And his hits, although not good in thinking about my son on the opposite end of them, were really entertaining. And he clearly was playing with passion. And I just really respect that part of his game. And I remember like the first time, I think it was at a Weekender, I was watching him go up against young Andrew Luck. And it was like Andrew Luck's welcome to the Pac-10 at the time. And I think Ray may have hit him just on the edge of the sideline, but it was sending a message. And as a fan, I couldn't have been more fired up for that moment, for my team, for the coaches, for Ray, and setting up a rivalry with Andrew Luck that lasted the remainder of his Pac-10 career.
I want to, because fans are getting primed, right? You're getting primed, I'm getting primed. Season's, you know... First game I'm calling is 35 days away from the time we're recording this podcast, and we're going to release this literally game week of week one of college football. So here we are, fans listening are a couple days away from running to their stadium and finding their seat. And fans are fans of habit, right? I need to put my left sock on first. I got the right underwear that I wear for every game. Sure. If I've worn this shirt 37 times to a game. Coach them up a little bit. Like, give them, like, the feng shui lesson of energy that they can bring to the game. I mean, clearly this is going to be a general conversation because you don't know every fan in every stadium. Sure. But I think we can stress ourselves out. So much so that I've met fans who are like, we lost when I went. I won't go to another game. Or the third quarter, I have to take a lap around the stadium 1.5 times, walk back through Tunnel 37, count to 10, and then go find my seat. Like, that's crazy to me. Mm-hmm. But... I also enjoy it as a fanatic of sport.
Yeah, so I'll let you in a little bit on some of my explorations of superstition, and then I want to tell you a story that my feng shui master taught me. So in our house, we're kind of famous for lots of statues. Buddha, Ganesha. You know, sometimes they surround the TV, and anyone who's ever watched a Hawks game with us, they know things aren't going well. Those statues turn around at some point when we need to change the energy. So I think it was like in the Green Bay game, in the NFC Championship game, where they were, Russell thrown like 5 interceptions. We had been eating cheese because somebody invited somebody over, and I was like, we're eating the wrong food, people. This is not appropriate if we want the Hawks to win. So anyway, we changed the energy of that, and that was the miraculous win that catapulted them into the Super Bowl. I definitely feel responsible for that. 100%. You're welcome. In some small part. The other thing is, like, whatever gets you into a positive headspace or an anticipatory headspace, you know, I really appreciate the idea of something good's about to happen. And applying that to any situation. So if things are going well, it's just going to get better. If things are down, well, it can't get much worse. It's about to turn is a great framework, a great mental sort of approach to it. I grew up on the East Coast. My family had one rule. We may have said this. This might be retreading old ground. But I think it was an unspoken rule. You didn't root for any team that ended in ETS. No Jets, no Mets, no Nets. So we were Yankees, Knicks, and Giants fans in our house. And to be fair, my dad's had a long history with the Giants. And one in particular, my stepdad, would tend to get down on them. He'd get down on those boys around the third quarter. And it didn't feel good. The idea of anticipating the game's over never felt right to me. So I had to find my own relationship to sport. And so I'm sort of one of those people that is always looking for a way. And I'm not going to give up till the end because I'm seeing that embodied in the players that I root for and the coaching. And it comes from the top down. So I've now, like, it's been imprinted on me as a fan. And it feels really good to have positive anticipation throughout the game. So there are ways to do that. You know, I mean, if Russell Wilson could take a shower at halftime, there's no reason why we can't go take a shower at halftime. There's no reason we can't take a walk around the block. There's no reason we can't do 5 minutes of breathing and turn the game off. There's no reason we can't turn the sound off if the commentators, no offense, are annoying us. There are definitely different ways we can change the energy for ourselves. You know, like what we take in is just as important. Part of me's glad Marshawn's gone because I don't have to eat any more Skittles, man. I was getting sick eating so many freaking Skittles. So I'm going to have to figure out what food Cam Chancellor and Michael Bennett want me to eat in the sidelines. And, you know, maybe one of them will be into like a chia bar or something. a little healthier.
I think that's amazing because I think as a fan, we're really serious about our sport. You know, as a broadcaster, I'm really serious about my sport. I have my processy that I start on Sunday at 3 in the afternoon that takes me to kickoff and really takes me till I get on the plane on Saturday night or Sunday and restart it and go again. And I think it's important to note that there's an art to that. It's not just being a crazed fan or a type A professional or whatever it may be. And to your point of resetting, I think it's pretty cool to apply that to life, right? And this whole podcast is about exploring what it means to be human. And in season two, it's about giving people the tools to explore that. And I believe you know this already. I think being human means to go for it. Mm-hmm. Live your most authentic, most purposeful life. And for me, it's to be a seeker. And now I get to seek through sport and college football. For people that want to shake up their energy, you know, shake up their vibe, just shake up their world. You don't have to be into the word energy or the phrase feng shui. You have, I feel like, a couple simple, subtle tools that can help people shake things. And it's an interesting time in the world, wherever you lean, whether it's politically, business-wise, employment-wise, whatever it means, you know, relationship-wise. Can you give our listeners a couple tools to reshape their world a little bit, reshake up that energy and get it down a direction that they aspire to have?
Yeah, so here would be three simple things that I'd say can certainly apply to within the game or within life. So one of the first and most powerful ways that I can change my energy is by activating my parasympathetic nervous system. And so 4-7-8 breathing is something that I use all the time in my acting coaching. It's something that I use in the waiting room. It's something that I use pretty much any time I want to slow things down. So 4-7-8 breathing, basically the number 4, the number 7, the number 8 relate to the inhale, how long I hold my breath, and the exhale. So if I inhale to the count of 4 and then I hold it for a count of 7 and I release that air through the count of 8, what I'm doing is my exhale is longer than my inhale. And so it's consciously slowing my heart rate down. It's consciously reactivating my parasympathetic nervous system. Because all of life, when we're going for it and letting it rip and like getting after it, we're all sympathetic all the time. And so just even a few moments of that, a few minutes of that is really powerful. Changing my breath. Pattern interrupt, if you will. I'm interrupting my normal, you know, not breathing deeply or whatever else is going on. The other thing I would say is change your physiology. So if you're watching a game, go outside and toss the ball around, you know. Get yourself in the energy of what it is you want to experience in the game, you know. Like maybe you made a great catch and you come back in with that optimism for the second half. Tony Robbins does this every morning where he does a hot and cold plunge. And he drives the, you know, sort of blood away from his heart and towards his heart. And so if you have access to like a cold plunge in your home, like he does, go for it. But anything that change your physiology, you know, jump rope, 5 minutes, go. Get out of your head. I feel like so many of us in big cities are sitting from our neck up and we're like moving from one box to the other, sitting in our car, doing all this stuff. So like get in your body for a few minutes, you know, get in your body, change your breath. And then I don't know. There's something to me about tunes. Tunes are so quick to get me there. And when I first met, I have to tell you that story that my feng shui master said, by the way, about superstition, because I just remembered it. When I first met my wife, I could tell that she was really invested in her career. And I knew I couldn't reach out to her as much as I felt like it, because that would be scary. I felt like it a lot. I was falling in love, man. And so I realized if I made a playlist that just lit me up and I like walked through Whole Foods, like, you know, dancing a little bit and singing in the car and all that stuff, she would tend to reach out to me more often than not during that time. And so I felt like I was like drawing in a certain type of energy, and then the energy was coming to me from another source. So
now, is that a real thing?
It's a real thing. I mean, like, that's just my anecdotal evidence.
Right.
But the idea is, like, if you put yourself into the energy of something, be the change you wish to see in the world. Right?
Okay, so pause there for a second, if you don't mind. Do you have to do those three things in any specific order? I hope you say no.
No.
Okay, cool. So let me just try to reframe this thing.
Yeah.
right? If I'm going to listen to a playlist, that's my drive to the game.
Yeah.
If I'm going to get in my body, I'm going to play catch at my tailgate.
Yes.
And if I'm going to breathe, that's the national anthem. Right. Sure. Now, I am primed to give the optimal cheer fest, regardless of whatever. Rice-Eccles Stadium on Thursday night, in the game that I'm calling week one.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really cool, and I think that's really digestible.
Cool.
Before you tell me your story,
yeah.
I want you to share with us, like, is energy legit? I think it is, clearly. You think it is, clearly. But there's somebody that's listening that's like, man, that energy stuff, mm-hmm. are you kidding me? Now, granted, my response would be, have you ever been to a game? You can feel when the energy comes, how we started this conversation, this podcast off. But as an expert, tell me why energy is legitimate and why it's actually real.
I mean, we can look to the second law of thermodynamics. We can look to anything from every action has an equal and opposite reaction, which to me is the law of karma. We can look to the idea that energy cannot be created or destroyed, only transferred, which to me is a case for reincarnation. Those are big conversations to be had. Karma, reincarnation. I believe in the golden rule. I believe in the idea that what you give out comes back to you at some point. I believe in the idea that if you give, you get twice. You get filled up on the way out, and then there's a reverberation that comes back. These are the principles through which I live my life because it feels good. So I think energy, like gravity, exists whether you believe in it or not. I think energy is a residue of past actions. So emotion times picture equals energy. If you just think about it that simply, emotion, the emotion you feel when looking at a picture, equals energy. And that energy is a residue that's left over and builds over time. So spaces become filled with that. You know, come to a stadium after your team had a crushing loss. You know, if you're that kicker, if you're that fan who, like, laid it on the line, you have that disappointment still in your body, it might linger as an echo in the space. So it's really important to do a space clearing. Your mind, the actual physical space, bring in a shaman, whatever you need to do.
Right. So it's interesting because I go to the dark side on this.
Yeah.
Emotion times picture equals energy.
Yes.
We all have emotions.
Yes.
We all see pictures, ideally. If we hold that energy in, that's why we blow up, right? That's why we can maybe get frustrated. That's why we can explode on a friend or a partner or a coworker. Or maybe it's why we light up an official, whatever it may be. Is that accurate?
100%. I mean, there's certain buzzwords around feng shui community you'll hear, like balance, harmony, and flow. And I think we could talk about this all day. We could talk about balance, balanced attack. We could talk about harmony, like team harmony and team chemistry, team harmony. We could talk about flow, this idea of like the pace of a game or the idea of going with what's actually happening, not just the idea you had in your head, coaches. And so, you know, why do you go for it on fourth down as opposed to, because you're reading the crowd, as opposed to like the smart thing to do in that moment? So balance, harmony, and flow are really important. And the only things in nature that cause, well, one of the things in nature, if you look to like a river, let's say, or a human body, when there is no flow, that's when disease builds up. So if the stream is not flowing, that's when bacteria and algae and things that cause sickness build up. When you don't express, that is the same thing in the body. Like if your body doesn't have proper flow, blood isn't flowing to certain places, like that's when illness happens. So this idea of like expression, we have to express the emotion, the idea of emotion. If you break it down into energy in motion, emotion is energy in motion. So stuck energy is simply the energy is not in motion. It's frozen in time. It's not unlocked. It's not allowing itself to be expressed.
That's awesome. Okay, hit us with your story.
Yeah, man. So my feng shui master is from Hawaii. L. Nathan Batun is his name. Big football fan, by the way. 49ers. So Nate Batun tells me a story about how a family from Hawaii moves to the States. Shortly upon moving to the States, they go through these inexplicable streaks of bad luck. And so he talks to them on the phone and says, well, did you feng shui your house? Of course, Nate, we did everything that you suggested. Okay, great. So he's meditating. He often would meditate in the tub. I can't tell you how many times I talked to him while he was in the tub when I lived in New York, because he was just there for everyone and didn't matter what time of day. So he sometimes got his best ideas in and around water. So he had this idea for them, He said, "You didn't by chance bring home any lava rock with you, did you, from Hawaii?" And they were like, "Yeah, because you told us the story of how that curse, quote unquote, got created. And since you told us how the curse got created, we thought it didn't have any power." And he goes, "Send it back." So if any of you have watched the Brady Bunch, you know that there are certain things you can do in Hawaii that really mess up your mojo. On the island, the big island of Hawaii, there's lava rock. And the story goes like this. Sometime when mainland Americans started to visit the island of Hawaii, they used to be taken to sacred places in Hawaii on yellow school buses, tour buses. And sometimes they would take a piece of the island back with them. They'd sneak lava rock into their pockets. And so they bring those lava rocks onto the bus, and that lava rock would flake off. And the man who brought them on the tour is trying to embody the Aloha spirit, would have to sit there and scrub the bottom of his bus for hours after the tourists had left. And so he asked them at first, "Please don't take lava rock home with you." And they did it anyway. They started to sneak it. They stuffed it in bags. And so he said, "Something has to be done." So one day he decided to tell a tour group, "There is a curse on the island of Hawaii that says if you take lava rock home with you, it's bad luck." And so 50 people that day put their lava rock down. And then 50 more people, and 50 more people, and then the word spread. And so now you have thousands of people, millions of people with a belief, combined with the words that were spoken aloud in a place that's a lot of people believe is an energy vortex, a concentration of energy in Hawaii. So the words were spoken aloud in a place of concentrated energy, and now millions of people believe it. That's home field advantage. That's how curses, or that's how mind, hive mind, gets created. So that can happen in the positive, it can happen in the negative, but it just shows us the power of our words, the power of belief, and the idea that there are items that can be the embodiment of that belief, and that those can have real world implications. You know, a couple years ago, Yankee Stadium was demolished. They built a new one just down the road. And somebody bragged that they buried a Red Sox jersey inside the new Yankee Stadium. So they made a debate, like, you know, it's not very good for people to be put into concrete. Do we leave it in there? And so they actually decided to, like, dig it out. And it was a David Ortiz jersey. But the idea of, like, somebody planting that in there was to put a curse on the Yankees in retaliation for the curse of the Bambino that they had to suffer through for many years. So this idea of, like, superstition in sport is really, like, aligned with a lot of, like, what you'll learn in feng shui. I'm not a big proponent of giving a lot of power to negative thought or superstition. So a lot of what I do is trying to carve and parse the difference between an energy cure and a superstition. That being said, if millions of people believe something, I have to be super strong in my mindset to be able to counterbalance that. So there's some things that are better to just respect.
Amazing. Last question before we kind of wrap up, at least on this topic.
Yeah.
Okay, so take me into a stadium, right? And let's just take the Coliseum.
Yeah.
Because you know we're in Los Angeles. So let's take the Rose Bowl, because you've been there before.
Yeah.
And we're UCLA, we're SC. And for a team, a visiting team, to come in to a place that has such great energy around both of those respective programs, or any visiting team to go into a stadium around a program that's had success in that stadium, what does it take to overcome the energy that's already built? Is it a stat that I track, which is now unforced errors, right? Is it to not have any unforced errors? Is it to be extremely aggressive? I know I'm not asking you to be an analyst of college football and schematics, but fundamentally to break the barrier, which is a fan base committed way that what this stadium does, with it really loud on third down. You know, Pittsburgh and the Heinz Field, they pour the ketchup bottles on third down or in the red zone, fans go crazy. What does it take for a team to come into an opposing environment?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's three layers that jump to mind when you ask that question. The first one is you got to be connected to yourself. If you're disconnected from yourself, you're out of alignment with you, you're not going to be able to be the best version of yourself that's possible that day. So you got to find a way, whether it's something you've done a million times before or something you're trying for the first time, you know, we could have a debate about the idea of a pregame ritual and whether it makes sense to do the exact same thing every time, or whether the idea of those principles and just shake it up and do what needs to be done in that moment. But connect to you, I think, is number one. The second thing is connect to something greater than yourself. Connect to source. Because to me, without that, what are we doing? Right. Like, what is this all for? You know, I got to connect to me because I have to remember during this experience who I am and be myself and be authentically me. But I have to connect to something greater than myself, which I do before I go to battle with energy and I bless a space or I walk into someone's home. And then the third thing is, I think you have to reframe. I think you have to pull a Kobe and feed off of the energy that you're being given, but reframe it into something positive instead of against you. It's almost like Aikido in reverse. So in Aikido, energy's coming at you and you want to like shove it to the side. But I think in energetic Aikido, you feed off that energy and you see people that have learned to reframe it on the sidelines, and it's powerful business. And if you can do that, if you can connect to yourself and be authentically you, if you can connect to something greater than yourself, the reason that we do this, and if you can connect to source, and then finally, if you can reframe the energy that's happening in the stadium for your advantage, I think you're unstoppable.
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. You know, the reason I played football was because the crowds are the biggest. And I love nothing more than going into a stadium, right? You hear the cliche of we just want to silence their crowd. But there's a power to that. That is like so true. And it lights you up in so many unique ways as a performer. And it's hard. I mean, I can remember just coaching at SC and we'd do the Trojan Walk. And we were good then. We were top teams in the country. And there'd be 15, 20,000 people on this walk. We'd walk in and it was priming us, right? And then we'd stop at the top of the collie and stare at it for a minute. Then we'd walk down the stairs. And the majority of the time, the opponent was already on the field doing the early warm-up. I can remember playing Notre Dame, and we walked past, like, Jimmy Clausen. Ron Paulus was their quarterback coach. He was, like, my childhood idol. A cast of other players. And you knew in a heartbeat. And it was because our guys kind of gave him the stare down, and they tried to bow up, and they immediately became something foreign to who they were, right? They tried to respond to that energy, but it was so false in confidence that we just rolled, and we were so grounded in real confidence that was just like the cherry on top of walking down the steps. But it was this great process for us to prime ourselves for, you know, the competition in front of a sold out crazy atmosphere, and we fed off that. We did the same thing in opposing stadiums. You know, you can remember the Bush push game. That was also the inauguration and the integration of the rocking of the bus. We got out there, 10,000 Notre Dame fans are wanting to tear our heads off on a Friday walkthrough. We start to rock the bus, and we fed off of that energy, and it became a thing. Now every school in the country rocks the freaking bus on their way to the stadium. So I think that's really cool, of connecting to yourself and then utilizing the energy in a foreign environment or your own to generate, you know, the vibe that you have, the energy you have, the feng shui that you have.
Yeah, and I think to that point, beyond three layers, the three things I brought up, there's something about connecting to each other. You know, you and I have talked a lot about the concept of one heartbeat and the long tail and the idea of like the group energy. And the group energy can be the people right in front of you. They can be your grandfather, your father, your mother, or somebody who's looking out for you from above. They can be the ancestors in the tradition of that school, like if there's other players. And leaning into that, leaning into each other, popping your focus to your teammate, popping your focus to the people who have come before, whose lineage you're honoring, and why you do what you do in terms of your own family. I mean, those things give me a lot of extra juice.
I love it. Okay, man, before we let you go, what are you seeking?
I constantly am seeking the enfoldment of clarity. I'm seeking the joy of my own experience. I'm seeking to leave things better than I found it. I'm seeking better. You know, I'm really curious about that. And, you know, you've inspired me so much with your podcast. You know, I want to continue to have conversations about what better means to other people and how we can all get there together and support each other in the process.
Love it. We've asked you this once, but I want to ask you again because it's over a year later. But how do you feel about the word limits?
Limits. It's cool, man. It's cool hearing you talk about them from the standpoint of watching them disappear. I struggle with them. The human me struggles with limits. I struggle, you know, with feeling my heart pounding in my chest at the end of a workout, feeling like that's as much as I got in this moment. At the same time, the next time, that same limit doesn't exist to me. So I'm constantly about pushing them, but I'm also about respecting them. You know, respecting the one I have today. You know, in addition to that conversation you said about CTE, I know that there's this other thing that's not talked about a lot, which is, you know, when people overheat, the kids overheat. And part of the reason maybe they took away two-a-days. But the idea of respecting a limit for now allows us to come back and double up and keep going later. And so I respect somebody who's like, screw that, I'm going to go as far as I can now, and I'll just keep going until I collapse, you know? But I also think, as I'm 42 and getting a little cricky, listening to my body and honoring that and like honoring where I am in this moment, the wisdom of that allows me to go further tomorrow.
That's awesome, man. I appreciate you coming on. This is a blast.
Absolutely, brother. Anytime.
I love it. All right, there it is. Ariel Joseph Town, Yogi Roth. And as we always end this podcast, in the heart of Los Angeles and Hollywood here with the sounds of basketball and soccer and the playground all around us, a quick reminder that the only limits that we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. Peace.